It is always lovely to be at the Freud Museum and to have an opportunity to talk about here about a topic which in a way would have been very controversial, I think, in Freud's lifetime, the relationship of Freud and Jewish identity and Zionism, the questions about whether there is anything specifically Jewish about psychoanalysis. People here will know that Freud was very ambivalent about this, and that's something that Aaron Rolnick and I hope we'll talk about later. Personally, I don't think there's any doubt that there's a considerable infusion of Jewish identity and perhaps even Judaism in psychoanalysis. And to me, one of the things that this book, Freud in Zion, demonstrates again is just how intimately psychoanalysis is involved in the construction, particularly of 20th century Jewish identity, and perhaps even specifically 20th century Jewish masculinity. And those are the kind of things I hope Aaron and I will talk about as we go through the evening. Just a quick word of introduction of Aaron Rolnick, who is a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst in Israel, in private practice there, and a training psychoanalyst at the Max Eitingon Psychoanalytic Institute, the founding of which is in a way one of the central elements in this book. And again, that's something that I think we'll talk about. Many of you will have heard the name of Max Eitingon, I'm sure. Max Eitingon. If you haven't heard of him as a psychoanalyst, you might have heard of him as a reputed spy. And we'll, I'm afraid, probably put paid to that element of his reputation during the course of the evening. But if you want to hold it as a fantasy, please do. Aaron has worked on this book in one way or another for quite a long time, I think. Yeah. It was published in Hebrew in 2007. He's done the translation himself into English and changed it dramatically in the course of so doing. So that although this is a translation of the Hebrew edition of the book, it's a new book as well. And I hadn't actually realised that until we just how extensive that change was until we just had a word a moment ago. So that's perhaps something that we can hear a little bit about as well, about what translation does, given that psychoanalysis is itself in many ways a discipline of translation of the unconscious, but also certain kinds of translation of language as a patient speaks to an analyst and as an analyst speaks back. And the book actually is going to come out in 2 weeks, I think you said, in German, which obviously was the original language of psychoanalysis as well, and of the founders of what was then the Palestine Psychoanalytic Society. So apart from that, Aaron, say, is a psychiatrist as well as a psychoanalyst, many years of clinical experience and practice, a great, very extensive teaching history, which I won't read out to you. And one thing I would like to, though, note is that he's done a considerable amount of translation of Freud into Hebrew, as well as being scientific editor of some significant volumes of psychoanalytic work that have been translated into Hebrew. So perhaps that is one of the themes that we could hold in mind as well, that question about what happens to psychoanalysis as it is translated from one culture to another. That's a very significant feature of psychoanalysis from the beginning of its history. The way we're going to structure this is I'm going to stop talking in a moment and invite Aaron to speak for a while, probably 20-25 minutes, about the book, but specifically about the ideas in it. I mean, I have quite a few interests in it. I have actually read the book twice, and I do want to say that I bought this book and read it before I was asked to speak about it here, which was a great shame because I could have got it for free. And then somebody else, an ex-student of mine, who's actually a Cypriot, sent it to me. He obviously saw it and thought, this is a book for me. So I've got two copies of it, one of which I paid for, one of which I haven't. Freud Museum haven't provided me with any. So it's totally altruistic speaking here tonight, and really out of considerable interest. And I think it's a really fine book, and I thought that before I knew I was going to be speaking with Aaron. Lots of things in it. Some things in it I knew, lots of things in it that I certainly didn't, and we'll talk about many of those things, I think. Quite a lot of things that I think will be of interest to an audience here. Obviously, I don't know many people in this audience, so I do know some of you, but if we just think about ourselves as located in Freud's final home in London, I'm particularly interested, Erin, in whether, in the course of your opening remarks, you could say something about this question of the Jewish dimension of psychoanalysis, which runs right through this book. It's a prolonged debate. Is there a Jewish... You know, there's clearly a relationship between Jews and psychoanalysis. We only have to look to its early history and know that, you know, until 1906, all Freud's immediate circle of new psychoanalysts were Jewish. It wasn't until then that any non-Jews turned up at his Vienna home to discuss psychoanalysis. So there's a simple sociological way in which psychoanalysis has always been Jewish, but more, there's a bigger question. To what degree do Jewish insights, consciousness, identities inform psychoanalysis? To what degree is psychoanalysis, as we know Freud in many ways wished to be, to what degree does it transcend any specific cultural or ethnic origin? And secondly, the other thing which is a real core of this book is the specific history of psychoanalysis in the Yeshuv, and I'm sure you're going to talk about that. I've asked Erin to explain some basic things right at the start, what the Yeshuv was. So I won't do it now, but you need to know a little bit of the history of psychoanalysis in pre-state, pre-Israel Palestine, in Mandate Palestine, in order to know what this book is about. But it's not a simple historical question. It's a question, for example, about the relationship between individualism and psychoanalysis as an individual-focused discipline and a society that was growing to try and form itself as a new society and was heavily ideological in the period of the 1920s and 30s and early 40s, which this book really focuses on. So there's kind of some general questions there as well as questions which are specifically about psychoanalysis in its early Zionist forms. I think that's enough for me at the moment. I invite you to come in and take that and other things as you wish.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you all for coming here tonight. I'm going to talk, probably read, for about 20 minutes and hopefully touch on some of the topics Stephen here mentioned. And even if I failed to discuss something that is significant, we'll probably have a chance to come back to it. Because one of the things with this study is to try and introduce it to, and this was my main objective when I started to write the book, especially the English version of this, the English edition, was to help non-professional historians and non-analysts access this topic. So let's just say at the outset that, you know, it is often said that for a psychoanalyst's love affair with psychoanalysis is never fully consummated until one is given a chance to talk at either Berger's Anointing, 19 Berger's in Vienna, or in 20 Master of God. So here I am fulfilling this second bit of a psychoanalyst's fantasy. And my own pleasure and gratitude, actually, for being able to present my book here tonight, I think should be interpreted on various levels. For many years, this house in Hampstead epitomized the tragedy of European Jewry in the 20th century as much as it epitomized the hopes of German-speaking analysts that a new psychoanalytic diaspora will again flourish in and outside the German cultural sphere, which in Freud's time was considered, you know, the prerequisite for a true psychoanalysis. So Freud was always suspicious of any psychoanalysis that was not German speaking, and this is especially true for an English speaking psychoanalysis, even though the British psychoanalysis was a source of great pride. On a more personal level, I just said to Stephen, it was about 15 years ago that I visited this house for the first time, and that was when I actually started my research. And I came here to the second floor to check out the archive, and I was handed over a file which said Palestine. And I started it contained several letters Freud was sent to, and Freud sent to Palestine, and immediately I cried out in despair. How could anyone read this man's handwriting? And then came a voice from the other room, said, blood, sweat and tears, blood, sweat and tears. And it turned out to be Michael Mauner's voice. And I think if you those of you who know this house know that Michael Mauner played a very important role in many historical studies that were made during these days. I would like to take this opportunity also to thank Carnac for publishing this book in its History of Psychoanalysis series, and of course Ivan Ward and the museum for inviting me to present it here, and of course thank you, Professor Stephen Frosch, for this generous introduction. We're meeting here actually today for the first time, and I trust this audience knows you fairly well, and trust, yes, that it is your responsibility to keep this evening, you know, not too far from being interesting. they know you will carry this load. I began to take an interest in the history of psychoanalysis when I was still in medical school. It was somewhat of an oddity back then, but if you look beyond the personal peculiarity, the early 1990s, and that is when I went to medical school, were quite friendly to psychoanalytic historiography. People were becoming impatient with the polemical constraints and partisan agendas that dominated the field of psychoanalytic historiography for several decades. Actually, it goes back to Freud's notorious 1914 on the history of psychoanalytic movement, which was a very polemical essay which actually set the tone for a whole genre of a very partisan way of writing the history of psychoanalysis. Freud had his own issues there and agendas, but it kept, you know, disturbing actually and preventing our field from becoming a real field for professional historians. At about the time I took an interest in psychoanalysis, the scene was beginning to change, I think, and more professional historians were entering the field, and so I was fortunate enough to have good mentors and good scholars I could look up to. And there were more sophisticated studies and methodologically sophisticated studies, and sadly, I must add, the maturation of psychoanalytic historiography, history writing, was accompanied by what is known today as the fragmentation of psychoanalytic theory itself, and by an overall decline in its appeal in therapy. There might be some link. I don't want to get into that, but I suspect that historians are at their best when they operate under the assumption that their object of their study is dead or presumed to be dead. So they feel free to work and rigorously. And at the time, it seemed as if psychoanalysis was dead and buried, and we can investigate it without being interfered by the actual players. To give an illustration for the wind of change that my book could benefit from, I recall one conversation with Kurt Eisler, who was then still reigning over the Freud archives at the Library of Congress. He was, at the time, truly licking his wounds from the Jeffrey Mason affair, which bruised him badly. And I asked him if Series Z, I will tell you immediately what Series Z is, the notorious series of documents which were to remain sealed and unavailable for scholars for many years to come. I asked him if this series could perhaps contain leads to the story of psychoanalysis in Palestine. "You will have to find out for yourself," Eisler said, and he added, "After all, I didn't read all these documents, I just collected." Now, Eisler was obviously not telling the truth. He spent a lifetime collecting all these documents, and after all, he himself sealed them in Series Z, having read them and decided that they are not to be made accessible to scholars. But as it turned out, by saying that, he was also signaling that he would no longer stand in the way of historians and young scholars who were interested in studying the history of psychoanalysis diligently. And the next morning, indeed, I had a permission to obtain from the archives some of the documents in that Series Z. Now, truth be told, that in history, much like in psychoanalysis, you may set off with a fantasy about a particular document or a repressed memory, if we're talking about a clinical setting, that will speak for itself once discovered. But you soon realize that documents, however fascinating, never speak for themselves. They have to be interrogated and, above all, interpreted. And with this, I come to Freud and Zion, the book I wrote, which I think seeks to be both historical and critical, but by no means psycho-historical. My intention in this book was to reconstruct and interpret the interactions between intellectual history, social history, and theory, psychoanalytic theory, in a place that, while remote from Europe, was shaped mainly by the intellectual legacies, by the cultural images, and, of course, by the political debacles of that continent. Freudian theory's penetration of modern Hebrew culture, and this holds true for both the institutional version of psychoanalysis and the more popular versions of psychoanalysis. It cannot be understood in detachment from the circumstances that compelled psychoanalysis to move out of the German cultural sphere. Therefore, as with other episodes in the history of science and ideas, politics imposed for a while a common fate of a sort between a political ideological movement, Zionism, and a scientific movement, psychoanalysis. My book's 6 chapters, the Hebrew version had 13 chapters, it was much thicker, but the English version has 6 chapters, which cover the 3 broad contexts through which I view psychoanalysis' formative years in the land of Israel. The first of these is the appearance of the Zionist version of the European new man, and its connection to the Freudian view of men. The second is the migration, following the rise of the Nazis in Germany, of psychoanalysis out of Central Europe. And the third is the consolidation of psychoanalytic discourse in the Yeshuv, following the arrival of immigrant analysts and the founding of the Institute for Psychoanalysis in Jerusalem in 1933. Yeshuv, by this is what is designated here, is the Jewish society prior to the establishment of the State of Israel. So everything which refers to Jewish settlement in Palestine prior to 48 is called Yeshuv, which is in Hebrew settlement. Zionist historiography, and I'm sure you know that, is every bit as contentious as psychoanalytic historiography. So by venturing to juxtapose the histories of these two movements, intellectual movements, there is no way one can come up with a friction-free and agreed-upon narrative. But by and large, I think it would be true to say that Zionism program was first and foremost political, but the movement also encompassed philosophical doctrines, literary writings, and ideas that were more intellectual and theoretical than practically political. Even though Zionism was sometimes viewed, and regrettably, to my mind, still is viewed by many, as an incarnation of religious ideas, Zionist thinking at the start was characterized by its pragmatism and its ideological eclecticism. It engaged in an ongoing give and take with dominant ideas of its time that did not have any obvious connection to either nationalism or religious tradition. In engaging with Darwinism, Nietzscheanism, socialism, existentialism, and psychoanalysis, Zionist thinking ranged far and wide across the field of modern science and philosophy. These intellectual movements played an important role in the process of secularization that the European Jewish society underwent in the second half of the 19th century, and provided sometimes incompatible justifications, arguments, and values that were appropriate into the Zionist movement's derogated ideological arsenal. And I mention in passing that as popular as Freud was, Nietzsche was even more popular among Zionist readers. So you have various quite surprising thinkers who were incorporated into Zionist cultural depository. Zionist discourse deemed especially important those scholarly works that could offer alternatives to the traditional religious explanations for the existential plight of the Jewish people. Such scholarship could serve as a source of legitimacy and authority for the fundamental Zionist demand, which was to gather the word Jews in their ancestral land, where they could exercise sovereign power over the society, politics, language, and culture. In historical terms, then, the encounter between the repairers of the Jewish body politics and the healers of the Jewish soul, as expressed by the Zionist movement, was nothing less than dramatic. In pitching itself to young Jews, the Zionist revolution often played on eroticism and gender. To be a Zionist was to be manly, to be masculine. When Freud had his firstborn grandson, Ernst Jones, brought him from Britain, I hope he will become a Zionist. He was referring to manlyhood. It was understood being a Zionist was to be saved out of the effeminate Jewish existential state. The Jewish collective's national aspirations were depicted as physical and mental desire. The Hebrew pioneer, returning to the land of his forefathers, was likened to a small child returning to his mother. His desire for the land, like the desire of an infant for his mother's breast. For those who saw Freud's teaching as a call for humans to enter into themselves, to return to their original and authentic self, Zionism took on therapeutic meaning. And almost immediately, in the early 1920s, psychoanalysis found enthusiastic followers among champions of Jewish national particularity. In the new discipline, they found a fusion of radicalism and tradition amenable to their ideological ends. Freud's positivist idea seemed to reconcile Jewish particularism with both the universalism of European Enlightenment and German neoromanticism, thereby providing a scientific support for Zionism's romantic attempt to reconstruct a unified and unifying national past. And this is no exception for all national movements. The unification of a mythologization of the past, and Zionism was no exception here. Early attempts made in Vienna by leaders of Jewish youth movements, as well as by analysts such as Siegfried Bernfeld, to reconcile Freud's idea with post Marxism and the life philosophy, the Lebensphilosophie of thinkers such as Martin Buber, were an early indication of a very convoluted but very particular Zionist version of psychoanalysis, which would try to bring together the socialist version of Freud with the romantic version. And this tension would manifest itself until today, I think, in Israeli psychoanalytic discourse. Moreover, Freudian texts served as an intellectual arena where the meeting between East European Jewry and Central European intellectual tradition, Central European Jews, with their corresponding Zionist self-understanding, could contend and reconcile. As a case in point, I mention again, as early as 1920, Ernst Jones reported to Freud a conversation he held with the British Zionist Chaim Weizmann, who would later become the first president of Israel, in which Weizmann reported that poor Galician immigrants who arrive in Palestine with no clothes but holding Marx Kapital in one hand and in the other Freud's interpretation of dreams. I think nowhere else you'd find immigrants holding this faster than both these two texts. In fact, Weizmann's right hand at the time was a British psychoanalyst named David Eder, who went down in the annals of British psychoanalysis as the first analyst in Great Britain before Jones. He actually established the London Psychoanalytic Society years before the British Psychoanalytic Society was established. Well, Eder, who was, and rightly so, considered the first psychoanalyst of Britain, during the 20s, left his analytic practice here in London and became a very devout Zionist and came to Palestine. And he was a very significant functionary in the Zionist establishment. And let me read to you what Eder wrote in 1924. He tried to summarize psychoanalytically the experiences he made as a Zionist, as a Zionist leader in Palestine. He wrote, after returning to Britain in 1924, he wrote, he was concerned with what he called the veil of secrecy that he and his fellow Zionist leaders used to cover up facts that were known to all. Writing that during the time I filled a political role in Palestine, I noticed in myself and in my colleagues the satisfaction it gave me to have secret information, knowledge which must on no account be imparted to others. Of course, good reasons were always to be found. The people would misuse the information, or it would depress them unduly, and so on. Pretty exactly the parents' attitude about imparting information, especially of a sexual nature, to the children. Indeed, when our secret information was common knowledge, we still tried to keep it to ourselves, just as we do with our children, though we have ourselves been through the same schooling. So this is David Eder, a psychoanalyst turned Zionist, trying to bring together these two identities of his. In ensuring that the association between the personal suffering and the plight of the Jewish collective would not remain within metaphorical boundaries, a scientific connection had to be found between the private and the public, between the sickness of the individual and that of the collective, because the Jewish collective was perceived as ill, as a ailing body politic. The Jewish body and the Jewish politic were considered degenerate. I'm not using this terminus offhand. The most popular text during Freud's time was Max Nordau's text on degeneracy, and Nordau was Herzl's right hand in establishing the Zionist Congress as a neurologist. It is hardly surprising, then, that the first of Freud's essays to be translated into Hebrew, and this was a text that at that time hardly anyone took any notice of, was group psychology and the analysis of the ego. It's a very obscure text that until today, not very people are fond of it, or it's not very often studied in analytic institute, but it was picked by Zionist educators as the first Freudian text that would be required in establishing a Jewish collective. And it became for generations a required reading in school seminars and teacher seminars and in all sorts of educational circles in Palestine. From the 1920s, a number of papers, gradually more clinical nature, on the dreams of Jewish settlers in Palestine were beginning to appear in psychoanalytic journals. Particularly revealing was a conclusion reached by one physician from Tel Aviv. His analysis of the dreams of his German and Russian-speaking patients who recently arrived in Palestine convinced him that his patient had an unconscious knowledge of Hebrew. Even though they did not speak the language, they dreamt in this language. So, if you like, in Jewish Palestine, the unconscious was not just structured like any language, as Lacan would have it. It was structured like the language of the prophets. Several other dispatches from Palestine were sent to Freud. To give you one example, during the bloody events of 1936-39, which is known as the Arab Revolt of the 30s, a dentist from Berlin, who had recently joined the kibbutz in Palestine, wrote to Freud to inform him that some Arab villagers in Palestine were blessed with telepathic powers, that the only method of transmitting information available to the Arabs in between the villages during that revolt must have been by thought transference. So you have all sorts of orientalistic anxieties that Freud, he apparently cordially thanked the dentist for providing him with further evidence on the subject of telepathy. And those of you who knows Freud's thing with telepathy knows that it was a secret passion of his that he was advised to suppress, but could never really overcome. So here we had this dentist with whom he would correspond. Actually, they exchanged free letters. Could, you know, exchange freely with this strange dentist from a kibbutz about telepathy. It seemed that keeping psychoanalysis from deteriorating into a cultural and ideological curiosity in Palestine would require a special brand of psychoanalytic emissaries whose self-conception of a Zionist would not be commensurate with their identities of psychoanalysts. And here we come to this little group of emigre psychoanalysts, which I tried to follow in the book in a way of a group biography, a very small group that established the Israel Psychoanalytic Society in 1933, and headed by Max Eitingon. And it can well be doubted, I think, that had it not been to Max Eitingon, you mentioned his alleged espionage affairs, but he had some other, I think, characteristics which made him a very good candidate to combine this psychoanalytic self-understanding with the Zionist requirements. And Max Eitingon, let me sum up, he was a very important man in the psychoanalytic movement in the from the 1920s onwards. First of all, he was Freud's preferred candidate to marry Anna for years. Anna Freud writes about it in her letters to Eva Rosenfeld. Apparently, Eitingon didn't care much for her, and it was actually she liked him. And he in his writing and in their correspondence to Palestine, you can see that he's somewhat an old flame of hers. And he would found the Psychoanalytic Institute when he was forced to leave the Berlin Institute, which he himself founded and financed. Eitingon was a very wealthy man, and his personal wealth made him the movement's most important financial benefactors for nearly two decades. He held various other functions and positions in addition to what became his historically most significant role as the founder of what we call today, and this is how analysts are still trained in the IPA institution till this very day, the tripartite model in which psychoanalytic education is composed of personal analysis, analysis done under supervision, and lessons. Well, this model was invented by Eitingon and is still called the Eitingon model. His letter to Freud, about 2 weeks after arriving in Palestine, I think testifies to his determination to not let historical and societal circumstances interfere too much in his establishment of psychoanalysis in Palestine. He wrote to Freud, and I quote, "The intensive building that characterizes this place forces us to follow our own private path and not become absorbed too early in public life." And then he's adding something which is quite telling. "After all, it is the same people with the same problems we have been used to dealing with," in Berlin, of course, "as clearly neither Orthodox Jews nor Arabs are suitable in any way for psychoanalysis." Now, he was obviously very quick to blind himself to the two others of Zionism, which are Orthodox Jews and the Arab populations, indigenous Arab population. And he was deploying the same strategy used by those who constructed the new Jewish self. Paradoxically, in an ideological environment that tended to appropriate the individual's private sphere for the benefit of public interests, Freudian psychoanalysis gradually offered the immigrant the ability to re-examine the borders between inside and out, between the inner world and the reality outside of it. Interestingly enough, yet consistent with the reaction of most psychoanalysts at the time, neither the encounter with murderous antisemitism in Europe nor the imminent Arab-Jewish conflict were openly acknowledged or reflected upon analytically in the discussions held by the Palestine Psychoanalytic Society. Thus, for nearly six decades, Freudian psychoanalysis thrived in Israel, while it has become ever more evident that the Zionist revolution constituted a much more violent interpretation of history than had previously been acknowledged. And this, I think, raises the question over whether the price paid for the establishment of psychoanalysis in Palestine did not entail relinquishing some of its critical aspects. Did the desire to ensure a wide consensus regarding the merits of Freud theory in the collectivist and ideologist atmosphere of pre-state Israel, did it not bring Eitingon and his successors to steer psychoanalysis onto a pronounced anti-intellectual path, leading to a narrowing of its horizons? And I think a paradox becomes apparent. On the one hand, in the collectivist social reality that characterized life in Palestine, the ability of the analysts to retreat to the clinic and to pretend as if public sphere did not exist and to offer the individual an opportunity to recover her own private language and history. That was of immense significance. However, this very retreat to the clinic distanced psychoanalysis from critical intellectual discourse, where it might have contributed its share to the liberation of society from the neo-romantic, utopian, and at times almost messianic ideological elements then so dominant. The formative years of psychoanalysis in Israel were consequently shaped by a set of conflicts, or at least set of tensions, while popular psychoanalytic discourse worked ceaselessly towards diffusing the social pessimism that was part of Freud's work. It was left for the analysts to safeguard the therapeutic position of psychoanalysis. Now, clearly, the practice of psychoanalysis in post-1967 Israel poses a whole new set of questions. You cannot compare 1948 Israel to post-1967 Israel. This is a totally different environment, intellectually. But for a historically minded clinician, it requires a different mindset if we are to understand what kind of psychoanalysis is being practiced in Israel since the occupation of the territories. Now, it is well known that terror and persecution are always probing the limits of both the mental representation of the individual, but also of historical representation. But I think that working analytically at the frontier of militant nationalism, on the one hand, and religious fanaticism, both Jewish and Arab, on the other hand, is a challenge that, to my mind, shaped the self-understanding of Israeli analysts till this very day, and perhaps more than they can ever hope to acknowledge. So I'll stop here and any more.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a few things to ask about, and then we'll open it out, if that's okay. So we've got either 8:30, is that right? I just want to... I mean, there's so much in what you've just said, as well as in the book, and the audience will realise that what we've just heard is a selection of some of the major themes from the book, although there's also some ways in which you've turned it, I think, in your talk, which highlights things slightly differently. I think... one of the things I really am interested in here is this, what felt to me in the way you were speaking just now, I hadn't noticed quite as much when I was reading, this sort of contrast between psychoanalysis as Jewish science and psychoanalysis as Zionist science. That there's a, you know, the reputation of psychoanalysis as Jewish science is that it's kind of subversive, seditious, sexually obsessed, it speaks from the margins of society, and it has critical force. And so when it becomes defined, you know, like in a sense, formally as Jewish science under the Nazis, it means those anti-social tendencies that, you know, and the opposition is between a Freudian practice which opposes, you know, the individual and the unconscious to the demands of society, and another kind of psychotherapeutic practice in which the aim is to make the individual's unconscious congruent with what the social totality demands of it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the description that you give of psychoanalysis as it starts to appear in Palestine, in Yishuv, in Jewish Palestine, of the 1920s and 30s, and specific, not just following the founding of the Palestine Psychoanalytic Society, but even prior to that, you present a very strong case that what happens is an emphasis not so much on opposition, but on identification. on a practice of education and therapy which is trying to align a kind of rather slightly bedraggled group of European and East European migrants, particularly not particularly German, but particularly Russian, trying to align them with a new mode of statehood that will build a kind of utopian society. And that, to me, has much more resonance with the thing which, you know, that force which actually is opposed to psychoanalysis in Europe. I wonder if you could just say something, whether, I don't know if that makes sense, if it's right at all, but that and whether that's too, too stereotypical, a kind of opposition. But this individual, social, critical versus identification, kind of, those parameters come up very strongly to me.
I think, you're right, not only there are two contending forces within the local psychoanalytic discourse, but when you examine it closely, you see that the same people sometimes are wearing both hats. When they come to bring psychoanalysis to East European Jewish immigrants, they will play on the socialist collectivist chord and the Jewish chord of psychoanalysis. For instance, it's very easy to follow the popularity of Freud in the issue, because you see the amount of essays written and press reviews, and you see that every time that there is a report about a persecution of Freud or a persecution of analysts, you have the popularity rises. So out of solidarity, psychoanalysis is being identified as Jewish, and whatever is being persecuted is being identified and accordingly becomes more popular. And even Eitingon notices that the number of appeals for psychoanalytic therapy increases whenever there's a report about what's going on in Germany. There's a rise in requests for analysis after the some reports about the Gestapo visits to Freud in Vienna. Now, to go back to this issue of Jewish science, which is it's an irritating expression, because we wouldn't have used it if that. It's so loaded and soaked with anti-Semitism. But on the other hand, you have so many Jewish analysts identifying with this and using it as a substitute identity during these days. Now, I have to say that if there's one thing I keep changing my mind about is the idea of there being something intrinsically Jewish about psychoanalysis. As an analyst, I resent it. I don't like it. No science should have this attribute of being Jewish or non-Jewish. This is anti-scientific for me. On the other hand, as a historian, you cannot understand this phenomenon without taking into account that it's soaked in the Jewish experience. So how are we to reconcile these two things? We keep quoting, Anna Freud's speech at the Hebrew University, when she says, she almost admits that for Sigmund Freud, psychoanalysis was a Jewish science. This is it's not the right place to say that, but Anna Freud is not always the best interpreter of the father. She's not always the best interpreter. She's a remarkable clinician and a theoretician, but when it comes to the Jewish identity of Freud, I think she's missing something. Because Freud did not mean it to be a Jewish science.
Can I just interrupt a second? Because you quote in the book, if I remember rightly, this very famous passage from Freud that appears in about three different places, in Moses and Monotheism, and also when he winds up the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, in which he says, you know, when Titus destroyed Jerusalem, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai persuaded to allow him to go and form a yeshiva, a seminary in Yavne, and Freud says, we're going to do the same thing. So it's a kind of identification with the sort of exilic intellectual elements of Jewish history. There's a very strong sense, I think, at that moment that Yerushalmi points out, yes, that Freud is thinking about psychoanalysis as the continuity into the modern age of Judaism, new form of Judaism. I mean, it's debatable, but there is that notion, that sense there. Yeah. And yet what you get in your account of, which is thoroughly convincing, it's not Christian with your account at all, but what you get in this description of what's happening in the Yishuv, is something very different from that. It's not, whether or not psychoanalysis is a Jewish science, it's not that kind of Jewish,
of course,
because it's rooted in the land, for example.
Because Zionism, for many of it, is an alternative to Judaism.
Yeah, exactly.
So, for quite a few Zionists, Judaism, Freud is an old Jew.
So psychoanalysis is also Zionism. Zionism
is a secular movement, and which turns its back on Judaism. And of course, not to all Zionist wings, but mainstream Zionism, Eastern European Zionism, does not look at the Jewish tradition as a requisite for the Zionist revolution, but rather as an impediment to the fulfillment of the Zionist dream. So it may supply the fuel or the fantasy, but you have to break with this Jewish tradition in order to be a stalwart Zionist.
I mean, in what happens to psychoanalysis in the Yishuv, do you think that there is something that's true to psychoanalysis in it? Or do you think that what happens is that, in a sense, Zionism and the importance in everybody's minds at that point of nation-building takes over from what was evolving as a psychoanalytic worldview?
There's something peculiar about psychoanalysis, I think. People can go and misinterpret it, as they did in Palestine many times. But somehow the grain of truth, or there's a hard core which overcomes even the worst interpretations. So it's a nice thing, I think. If you take, for instance, the text you just mentioned, Moses and monotheism, of course, you couldn't find enough place in all of the issue newspapers to print all the outrage letters and essays that were written once this was published. I think that Freud thought he might make a publication text a test and publish it first in Hebrew when he was becoming apprehensive about publishing this text. And he wrote to Eitingon if perhaps he should publish it in Hebrew first. And Eitingon, who was then establishing the society in Jerusalem, said, no way. No, that would kill psychoanalysis here. But people kept reading into this text an attack on Judaism. Mm. And I'm quoting one particular letter of a rabbi and an intellectual who came to interview Freud and pleaded with him not to publish this text. Freud's Moses is, to my mind, is dealing with the psychoanalysis more than it does with Judaism. It deals with psychoanalytic knowledge and psychoanalytic epistemology. And the case of Moses is used to exemplify a psychoanalytic way of searching for the truth. But I, as you mentioned, Yerushalmi is reading it completely different. He's reading it as a testimony of a Jewish scientist who comes, as it is, full circle at the end of his life and trying to reconcile both his identities. Because, as you may know, Freud, very earliest papers, before he was a psychoanalyst, were against the degeneracy paradigm in psychiatry, which attributed to Jewishness specific illnesses. Now, to say about the same Freud that in his early age he comes back to Jew in a sort of essentialist way to Jewish traits and Jewish essence, this is as if we discarded the past 50 years of his career. So,
but there's a historical circumstance that changed.
There are historical
writing, you know, at the time. I mean, most of Marcy's middle written. You actually have some interesting evidence of it.
Yes.
I think about it very early in the 1920s, but it's basically written in the period of Nazism. From 1933 onwards, it's real, the core of that writing. The circumstances have changed considerably. Freud himself, we know, for a long time, hopes that nothing will disturb him, you know, that there will be protection in Vienna and so on. The Nazis won't come, you won't have to move, all that kind of stuff, everybody knows that. But there is both this sort of question that must arise about the continuity of anti-Semitism, which he deals with in that book, and also what I think he does very explicitly and very movingly in Moses and Monotheism, is this thought about what is handed down from generation to generation, mm-hmm. even if you don't want it. You know, what passes through and on between people in identity, and specifically writing about Jewish identity, even that thing you really don't want. And as we know, you know, as you know very well and write about very nicely, you know, he has a trauma theory effectively of that.
Yes.
But my point is that I'm not sure how well you can argue from his early distancing from it to his later, to argue that there's got to be continuity.
No, I'm trying to do justice to, you know, to look at this late work of his,
yeah.
which is rather fragmentary
and
not entirely clear, and to put it, to place it in the context of his entire corpus, entire writing, and to say that, you know, he did say that about Moses, and clearly he identified with Moses earlier on. He mentions Moses yeah. many times, even in 1914, in Michelangelo's essay. But to say that at the end of his life, and in view of the rise of Nazism, Freud became to think of his science as something particularly Jewish, I would consider it a misrepresentation of his life.
I agree with that. Although
I just
want to make one point, and I'll ask one more question and open it out. But just one point I want to make that relates to telepathy. The Freud, I'm sorry people have heard me say this before, but Freud has this wonderful comment, you know, in the 1920s, he says, and I think you quote this as well, in the 1920s, about 1926, he really becomes a believer in telepathy. Ferenczi has shown him some experiments. And he makes this known, and Ernest Jones is incredibly embarrassed about this, because, you know, he's trying to make psychoanalysis reputable. He basically says to Freud, just don't tell anyone. And Freud writes back to him and he says, well, look, don't worry about it. Look, if anybody asks, just say it's my personal issue, like my smoking and my Judaism. I mean, first of all, I love the quote, but also this idea, telepathy, smoking, Judaism, something slightly disreputable, you know, that passes through, you can't quite see it. You can't quite see these messages. The smoke is kind of just a haze lying in the background of psychoanalysis. I think it's a comment with some depth, as well as being a kind of flippant riposte to Freud. But maybe we can come back to that. Can I just ask one other thing and then open up to other people?
I was very struck in reading the book about particularly the sections on the new Jew and also on the way in which psychoanalysis is taken up in kibbutz and used as a sort of way of, you know, both a way of talking about sex and at the same time controlling it. But what really struck me was the genderedness of it. You know, I felt there was, this is again not a criticism, I thought this was a representation of what's going on. I thought there was very little in the book about femininity. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount about how the new Jew is like, you know, the muscular Christianity that was emerging at the same time. And we've heard all this before, Herzl's fascination with the muscles of the Jewish porters when he goes and meets them in Palestine for the first time. You know, he can't believe these are Jews. He's really fascinated by them in this kind of homoerotic way. And Freud isn't like that at all, but the take-up of psychoanalysis that you describe is one which it feeds into a society, which seems to be highly gendered in a very traditional way, despite the fact that obviously women in that society take on many more varied roles than was the case. But what I'm saying is there seems to be a mismatch between the representation of gender and the actuality of gender behaviour in some ways. And psychoanalysis is importing it into that, again, in a way which seems to do violence to the way in which we might think about it in terms of its, I suppose, more progressive aspects that were being worked on in the Berlin Psychoanalytic Institute. Mm-hmm. At that same time, you know, who do we have in the Berlin Psychoanalytic Institute? You know, we have Wilhelm Reich, you know, we have Otto Feenischel, those people, you know, who are pushing both the socialist and also the gender critical elements of psychoanalysis, and they just seem to disappear when they enter into Palestine. If you could say a word about that.
Both people were theoretically ideal candidates for the Palestinian Psychoanalytic Society. They were both socialists.
You were talking about Feenischel and Reich.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And held very close contacts to analysts who were actually going to Palestine. Feenischel was following closely the big experiment that was done in the kibbutz. It was, they thought that they were eradicating the Oedipus complex by, they literally wrote that, and they received support from, serious theoreticians. In the kibbutz movement, and especially in one fraction of it, the left-wing fraction, the Hashomer HaTzair, I think you had a Shomer HaTzair in Britain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a David Eden farm as well. Preparing people to go to...
Exactly. So a Shomer HaTzair had its own version of psychoanalysis, and which was scrutinized by the Berlin analysts, but still embraced. And until the late 50s, they were great fans of Freud, and they translated much from Freud and from Feenischel and from Reich, but always picking whatever they needed for their own ideological ends, which very soon turned out to be totally different than what you'd identify with the psychoanalytic view of man or of education. The collective showers, for instance, that the children used to do, or the collective child-rearing practices in the kibbutz, were said to, first of all, to equalize the gender differences. Boys and girls were together. And of course, to deconstruct the family structure, which was a big emphasis in Shomer HaTzair, thereby believing that the Oedipus complex will lose its impact on the development of neuroses. And I quote from the correspondence that one of the movement's analysts had with Feenischel. And he's writing to him that the children in the kibbutz are not exposed to the primal scene, for instance, because they don't see their parents then. They're kept somewhere else. and they get all the sexual education they need by watching elder children who teach them the way of life, or by watching animals, farm animals. So these were kinds of you know, idealizations of nature life, which we which are not particular to Zionism, but gender issue did play in the kibbutz in the way that marriage was considered insignificant. And not very looked upon as bourgeois and redundant, and excessive petting and love expression for children were considered by the educators of that movement as spoiling. You have a whole debate about how much a mother should be allowed to approach her baby, because she might start to treat her baby as if it was her toy. And they considered mother's love as narcissistically, basically, as narcissistic love. And I had a very interesting talk with an old educator who called me up after I published the book. A 19-year-old gentleman who was one of the main ideologists of the education in the kibbutz movement, and he told me that he regrets immensely the mistakes they did. And he mentioned, for instance, that in the 30s, babies were put to sleep on wooden beds and not on mattresses. To prevent them from being spoiled, to toughen them up. And he was very...
with the hands above the sheets.
This is something else. You know. But these experiments were made all over. I think even in Britain and in Russia, of course. You'd have all sorts of importing... pseudo analytic ideas and emulating them into progressive education and playing with them, trying to make a better man. Now, of course, their understanding of infantile sexuality was very concrete and some point ridiculous, but they made no secret of the ideological part that played there. So when you follow the debates of these educators, you see that it was said clearly that Freud had to be translated into a language which is appropriate for the needs of the society. Because the German Freud is a bourgeois Freud. As one writer is writing, and I quote him, Freud had no knowledge of natural life. He is a bourgeois Jew, a city-dwelling Jew, an intellectual. He never seen a herd of cows, and all he knows about life is from books, and he takes one look in a herd of cows to realize that, and so on and so forth. And the various examples to see. As I said in the introductory remarks, Zionism was importing every possible new ideas it could.
Okay, there's lots we haven't talked about, of course, but let's open that. You want to come in first? And
yes.
We may collect things, we'll just see how it goes.
I bought your book about 8 months ago when first published by Kana. And I thought to myself before I bought it, well, I read Peter Jay. What new things can you bring? And to my pleasant surprise, plenty, plenty, plenty. even when I went to buy a flat recently in Tel Aviv, it was a guide. I knew the names of people that you mentioned. And it was such a lovely, lovely experience.
These are actually all good locations, these people. We were the first. Every street name is a good location.
Absolutely. In the end, I bought in La Salle Street, which is in his writing. I'm not giving you the address, the number. But you mentioned very credible, there was a credible information there. And I like the style of writing because you did not disturb my thinking, you did not impose your thinking on me. But you gave me a lot and a lot and a lot and a lot of information. Where I disagreed a little bit is that Freud was very influenced from Judaism. He wrote the Book of Jokes, the sexual energy comes from Judaism. How to subdue passion and become a thinker, that comes from the old Pirkei Avot, the Proverbs of the Father, the Ethics of the Fathers. He was obsessed with Joseph, and in the end of his life he said that he would like to be like the Moses of the Old Testament and not the Moses of Michelangelo and Yohanan ben Zakkai as well. But he, in your book, I felt loving, I still love Freud, but also there is frustration with him that he warmed up towards Zionism in the end, and he wrote that when Einstein said to him, write something, he refused.
Can I hurry you up slightly, sorry, because other people as well.
Yeah, so... Gosh, I forgot what I wanted to ask. I skipped it.
That's fine, thank you. I'm going to collect a few of them. The lady here, and then...
If Freud, hypothetically, if you'd been hired as a consultant by the Knesset today, how do you think he would have approached the Middle East crisis?
Right, let's take another one. And I will
have to leave. This may be a more abstract version of the same question, but you made a very clear distinction about the Zionist analytic position as opposed to the religious orthodox position, but you're describing the state of affairs that's now the better part of a century in the past, and things have changed since then. So the question is, how does the Israeli psychoanalytic community respond nowadays when Zionism has become increasingly identified with religious orthodoxy rather than secularism?
Okay, and we'll take one more, and then you should speak now because of people behind
yes,
you.
What I want to say, I remember years ago reading the Jewish Encyclopedia on the position of women, and at that stage, this is a long time ago, I was reading on the development of the impoverished development of the superego in women, and I thought someone could write a straight essay linking the two. And Christianity and me see women in also form for me. But it's this differential in the moral development in male and female, which I think is particularly Jewish. And there was another thing, you know, Freud is still phallocentric. You know, thank God I wasn't born a woman. Well, but according to Freud, we're burdened by penis envy. And the only way we get out of it is loving our children narcissistically. So, I mean, the view of women is a bit...
But you're linking that with the Jewish view of women.
The Jewish view of women, yeah. Yes. I mean, there are lots of biases against women in the Christian tradition.
So let's take some cuts. So you've had a challenge on Freud and Judaism around his interest in the Bible. We've had questions about really what's happening, what psychoanalysis, I think, maybe not so much Freud, although it was from like that, what psychoanalysis has to say about tensions in Israel and Israel-Palestine, I suppose, currently, which actually, I just want to say, if you haven't read the book, Iran ends the book with, albeit briefly, because it's not the main focus of the book. And you've had this question about whether something in psychoanalysis is taken possibly from the Jewish approach to femininity.
But yes, Viewed historically, I think you cannot understand psychoanalysis, the rise of psychoanalysis, without viewing the Jewish dimension, both the Jewish origins of its founder and the circles in which psychoanalysis develops. Having said that, it would be, I think, and I'm even willing to consider the possibility that Freud knew Hebrew and concealed it.
Which?
Yerushalmi. I grant him that. I think he may have pointed. So, but this is not to say that Freud was knowledgeable in the Jewish sources, that Freud had a Jewish education. Freud was raised as a secular. And even though he did read Hebrew or got this or that Bible for his bar mitzvah from his father, this does not make him a Jewish scholar. It make him, you know, a Jew. This is not... If you're looking at Freud's library downstairs, or if you scan through his bibliography in the entire 50 years of writing, there's very little evidence that he knew much about Judaism. So why should we now look at this theory which he gave us and try to search for I wrote a review on Yerushalmi's book once, many years ago. I wrote a review on Yerushalmi's book when it was translated to Hebrew. I said then, perhaps it's time to stop searching for buttered Hanukkah menorahs in Freud's estate. You will find these menorahs, but they have little to do with what psychoanalysis is about. And I still think that even though you have an interest in dreams in the Kabbalah, or numerological ideas in the Talmud, and even though he mentions Joseph and Moses and others, we know so much about these other sources, which we could follow closely and see. There's no single... You mentioned Peter Gay, we know that. There's not a single person in the history of humanity on which we know more than about Sigmund Freud. Mind you. We know what Freud had for breakfast, literally, ever since he was born. The amount of material, archival material, historical material about Sigmund Freud is so much, so why should we ignore what we know and look for what is hidden? You know, sometimes... I take issue with that because in psychoanalysis you learn that the best way to hide something is on the table, not below. The unconscious mind that works like that. There were times where Freud made a very explicit attempt to hide his sources, intellectual sources, out of narcissism and envy. He writes about it. And whenever he reads someone who thinks alike, you mentioned the book of jokes. When Freud was working on the jokes theory, he discovered that the works of many German scholars, one of them was so much close in his idea to Freud that Freud stopped reading him. And he said that. He did not want his originality to be spoiled by other influences. He had an anxiety influence, as Harold Bloom went through. But I think we tend to press too hard on the Jewish dimension in his theory, in his personality, in his personal likes and dislikes. He makes no secret that he has a personal preference for Jewish friends and that they are endowed with a special characteristic that make them more accessible to a theory. But the theory itself is, I think, it would be a misrepresentation to say that this is a Jewish theory of the mind.
Could we take up the issue that two people have raised about?
Yes.
If I can answer it now, in a way. I'm thinking, if I could just elaborate very slightly, that there's a long history of psychoanalysis in situations of crisis and also in situations of dictatorship and so on. We have it, you know, in Germany, which you describe. We've had it in Latin America, and the way in which psychoanalysis, for instance, came to thrive under the dictatorship in Brazil. It's an interesting phenomenon. And in Israel, of course, we've got this long-standing chronic crisis, both of politics and of civil society, of religion, as was mentioned, and also of conscience, I suppose, within particularly perhaps within the educated elite, who you might also identify with psychoanalysis. So I'm interested in what your thoughts are on all that.
I think fact of the matter is that you have quite a lot of Israeli analysts who have been dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And written quite a lot about it. And there are quite a few volumes written on this, and there were several very well-known Israeli clinicians who were dealt with the Arab-Israeli conflict. But the question of their impact on public discourse is totally different. The impact of psychoanalysis, I think, on Israeli public discourse is very minimal. In that way, you cannot compare it to the South American version, where you can see that psychoanalysis has penetrated the discourse of the intellectual elite. In Israel, I think it remains insular and isolated to psychoanalytic circles. But the Knesset would not hire a psychoanalyst as a consultant for the Arab-Israel conflict. There were American presidents who did, years ago. I think in the 40s, 50s, American presidents hired analysts. But they will no longer do that. And in Israel, this is out of the question. Although, in the field, as it is, in mental health facilities, some analytic work is being done. Whether or not this can, you know, climb to a level of impact on the decision makers, I doubt it. I mean, to my mind, this conflict has not yet reached the stage where it can be receptive to analytic ideas. Sadly.
If we can take a few more, can we have?
Yeah, the gender question.
Can you do this briefly and then we can allow some couple of others, maybe one more round.
I noticed that I have very little to say about the gender question, because it takes us to a whole different direction, I think. Freud's take on femininity and women is well known, and you quoted some of it. Here again, you were trying to link his take on femininity and Judaism
in terms of an impoverished moral conscience.
And it's Delroy's book.
The only thing I can, you know, offhand contribute to this remark is Anna O's visit to Jaffa, Bertha Pappenheim,
yes.
Psychoanalysis prime patient, who became the founder of social work and the founder of Women's League. She came to Palestine in 1911, and her visit there, in her capacity as in her campaign against the trafficking of women, people tend to forget that Palestine at the turn of the century was a center for trafficking of women from East Europe. You know that. There was a big industry in East Europe of trafficking of women and selling them for prostitutes to South America. And they were sometimes tempted, the young girls, to stop in Palestine. Some of them were Jewish women, and some of the main handlers were also Jews from Odessa. And for this reason, Anna O came to Palestine in 1911 and gave a series of lectures in which she tried to show that there is a connection between the prostitution of women and their overall discrimination in society. And it is said that her visit, even though it was in such an early stage of that society, you can imagine the Jewish society in 1911, In Tel Aviv, it's hardly a, you can hardly call it the building of a nation. They seem to have been very receptive to her ideas, at least according to the press reports. And her lectures were a hit, and were the hall was full of people. Zionism was pretending, I would say, to secure a better place for the Jewish woman and posed itself as an alternative to the traditional place Judaism accorded to the woman. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, allowing women to work in the field, yes, is not really equal to women's rights.
My question is about identity within the state of Israel, contemporary Israel today. What it is to be an Israeli in the context of an indigenous population of 20% who are Arab citizens of Israel, Haredi Jews, immigrants still incoming from India and so on. And to what extent that is impacting on the psychoanalytic community in Israel, or indeed vice versa?
I just wanted to ask about Ernest Jones, I've written a book about it, I must say. But the fact is that the Welsh are known as the Jews of Britain. And I wondered whether Freud was aware of that connotation, and he allowed Jones to become his good friend.
Of course, as you know very well, James, he was also the Shabbosgoy of the psychiatrist, as I described himself. Okay, could take one more test, or okay, go with that. Choose a book away. Now,
answering your question with a question would be... how would you explain Jones's essay on the question of the Jewish people? Do you know this essay, The Jewish Problem?
No, I don't remember it. Of course, I've read it before I wrote the book, but no, I don't remember it.
This
but
is
I will
very,
reread it. Thank
this
you.
Is a very troubling essay. I don't recall anyone quoting it in the psychoanalytic literature, but he published it in 1947, I think, in which he's trying to... do you know it?
Yeah, because it's talked about in...
There was a time that everyone liked to hate Jones. It was a fashion to be very critical of Ernest Jones. And I think he's a unique personality, and his contribution to British psychoanalysis and to Freud is immense. And so are his essays. But as a Welsh, I'd be dumbfounded by this text he wrote. It's a downright anti-Semitic text. Had it not been written by a psychoanalyst?
He did also write The Inferiority Complex of the Welsh, though.
Okay, so
it's kind of reading enough,
yeah. But, I mean, he's mentioning the Jewish nose and all sorts of things. I mean, he's really using stereotypes.
But he did, I think there is some idea that he had some identification with the Jewish psychoanalysts, as, you know, in imagining himself as a minority.
Mm.
I think that's right. But maybe we're going to run out of time, so can we have your thoughts on this question, which was about the position, again, the position of psychoanalysis in this...
There is a peculiar thing, and the last chapter of my book, some writers use the epilogue to sum up the book, hence an epilogue. But I soon realized that in the epilogue, I'm not summing up the book I wrote, but starting to write the book I would like to write next. So the epilogue is a kind of the first chapter of the next book, which I hope one day will be written. And in this epilogue, I'm raising some questions about an apparent paradox, I think, or at least... On the face of it, psychoanalysis flourishes in Israel. It's one of the most, numerically, it's one of the biggest analytic societies in Europe. Applications to analytic training in Israel are on the rise. Psychoanalytic literature sells very well. Books are being translated. The field is blossoming. And this raises a question. What kind of psychoanalysis is being practiced in Israel or is being debated in Israel? This is certainly not the kind of psychoanalysis that Eitingon and his co-workers brought with them from Berlin in the 30s. Now, of course, psychoanalytic theory has evolved and changed, and the discourse of psychoanalysis has changed in Britain, in America, and everywhere else. This is science, and it evolves, and it has fashions, and why shouldn't it be like that in Israel too? But I think Israeli psychoanalytic discourse is influenced by the Arab-Israeli conflict in a way that, not only by the Arab-Israeli conflict, I would add here something that we haven't mentioned so far, and that is the trauma of the Holocaust, which became a focus of psychoanalytic research in Israel for many decades. So these two fields of interest, Arab-Israeli conflict and the the psychoanalysis of those directly or indirectly involved with the trauma of the Holocaust. These two fields gradually turned Israeli psychoanalysis into a trauma-centric discourse. By this I mean to say that Israeli psychoanalysis by and large tends to emphasize external circumstances. Now, in a society in which so much violence and the impact of so many atrocities are evident, and one shouldn't wonder. But if you think that psychoanalysis is about looking beyond external circumstances and trying to look into internal forces and internal aggression rather than societal aggression, so you see that Israeli psychoanalysis is caught between its obligation to psychoanalytic thinking, with its emphasis on unconscious and primary aggression, and on the other hand, its interest in societal and circumstantial adversities, let's call them, as influencing the individual. So I've said that you will see very little trace of psychoanalytic thinking in politics or in public life, but you will definitely see a special brand of analytic receptiveness to outer violence in the psychoanalytic discourse. Mm-hmm. The, if you look at the case studies of Israeli analysts and the case reports and the kind of case histories that are being submitted for by candidates at the Psychoanalytic Institute, the vast majorities of them are very receptive to Ferenczi's idea about the impact of external trauma on the activation of the death instinct, and so forth. I don't want to be too theoretical, yeah, but this is hardly a Freudian society as it was 30 or 40 years ago. I just mentioned one last quote from Anna Freud when they Eitingon's successors were trying to save Eitingon's library. After he died, his wife deeded over the house and the entire institute to the society, but there remained a huge library. Eitingon brought with him from Berlin one of the finest libraries that ever came to Palestine till then. Much nicer than Freud's library. Much nicer. Yes. Because he had more money. So he bought everything money could buy, and he was a very well-educated man, and he spoke seven languages. And so when he died in 1943, the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society was looking to inherit this magnificent library, but funded were needed, but since Eitingon was dead, there was no one to pay for the library. And they tried to raise money in analytic societies in America, in Europe, but it was post-war time, and no one had any interest in helping this small group to purchase a library. There were bigger issues to look after. And Anna Freud was approached, and she said, "I cannot help you. I have bigger trouble here in Great Britain with psychoanalysis. I just ask you to preserve this last, she's not using the word fortress, but the last strongholds of Freudian psychoanalysis. That it, from the point of view of Anna Freud in late 1940, in remote Palestine, that was the last place that Freudian psychoanalysis would still had a stronghold. In Britain, it was the Freud-Klein wars, and she was very pessimistic about the possibility of Kleinian and Freudian living together in the same society. She even contemplated establishing her own Freudian society, she wrote in that letter. And in America, there was ego psychology, which was a very American version of Freudianism. So Palestine was considered for four decades as a Freudian society until the late 60s, if you like, until the Six Days War. Then gradually this society is becoming more receptive or influenced by non-Freudian analytic perspectives. And it's changing its character in that direction today as well.
I just check. I'm a bit anxious about time. Yeah. What are we doing? We have to stop. We should wind up. Okay, I know there were some other questions, but maybe you'll hang on for a bit after if you want to chat to you a little bit. I really want to thank you. That was a very interesting place to finish, actually.
Yes.
There are lots of things to think about in that. Thank you for the book, which I do genuinely recommend. It's a very fine book, both of scholarship and of provocation. And also, of course, for the way you spoke to us.
Thank you very much.